The bedrock and surface deposits of Pennsylvania span over a billion years of geologic time. Pennsylvania literally rocks. Welcome to the PCPG podcast series. The Pennsylvania Council of Professional Geologists invites you to join us on a journey to explore the geology of the Keystone State and to meet the people who study it and work with it in their everyday lives. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome to a poorly sorted but well-rounded podcast, a production of the Pennsylvania Council of Professional Geologists. I'm your host, Russ Losko. When you're hiking a trail in Pennsylvania, or maybe driving past some Amish farm fields, it might be easy to think that the state is some kind of peaceful, bucolic place that never saw anything like calamity. Now spend an evening in Center City, Philadelphia after an Eagles game and you might get a different impression. But the truth is that Pennsylvania has been shaped by a long series of calamities, and these can easily be attested to by the complicated and often frustrating geology and soils of the state. So how did the Keystone State get to be what it is today? Now, growing up like I did in a rural setting in western Pennsylvania, just a few kilometers outside of the steel town of Ambridge, it was easy to get a narrow and skewed vision of the geology of the Commonwealth. This area is situated in the Pittsburgh Low Plateau, and all of the rock outcroppings that I played on as a kid were mudstones of the Pennsylvanian Castleman Formation. A little bit of research at the public library when I was in junior high school showed me that this meant these rocks were on the order of about 290 million years old. But experiencing only these rocks left me with the impression that all rocks were sedimentary and brittle. The term rock solid certainly didn't mean much to me back then. The shales near the house where I grew up were so fissile that you could pull them out of the outcrop with your bare hands. The only fossils I ever saw here were ferns. Across the Ohio River, I could see, but never really got a chance to explore, the bluffs of the Allegheny Formation that overlooked the town of Aliquippa. By the way, Aliquippa was Ambridge's arch rival in all those sports that I was never any good at. Sometimes in the summer, we would drive up to Crawford County to fish Lake Pimatuming. Here, the hills gave way to the flat expanses of the northwestern glaciated plateau. There were no outcrops here, just flat land, paraglacial swamps, and on a good day, some decent walleye fishing. For a few summers, we would take a vacation and visit a friend of the family up in Forest County outside of the thriving metropolis of Tyonesta. This friend's property backed up to the Allegheny National Forest. There, I discovered the sandstones of the Mississippian Shenango Formation. It was here that I encountered my first non-fern fossil, a cast of some small vertebrate skull collected along the Allegheny River. Here I also encountered my first rattlesnake. I actually found the fossil more fascinating than the snake. Unfortunately, my father, who thought that my collecting of rocks was a colossal waste of time and effort, discarded all of my rocks when I went off to college. He refused to tell me where he dumped them. He took that secret to his grave. But it wasn't until I left home the summer before college to study for a couple of months in the West Indies that I actually laid eyes on an igneous rock. Then, in college at IUP in the late 1970s, I was lucky enough to take Dr. Joe Clark's Intro to Geology class. There, I finally got to see specimens of metamorphic rock. There, I came to begin to understand the diverse geologic history of Pennsylvania. Nearly half a century later, after decades of fieldwork, study, and teaching, I've really come to appreciate how complex the geology of Pennsylvania is and just how little I really understand it. It's human nature to wonder how things got to where they are. It It's also human nature to wonder how long things have been around. This is why so many people are fascinated with history. This is why we see, for example, so many Civil War reenactors, and increasingly more World War II reenactors. I do find it interesting that we don't find very many Cretaceous reenactors, but I could see where that would be difficult. I mean, imagine a bunch of people trying to act like small rodents while giant dinosaur reenactors stomp around them. How's that for a mental image? For as long as humans have been anything resembling humans, there's been a curiosity about the timeline. We all want to know what the backstory is. Anthropologists tell us that this is in part a result of humans living long enough for grandparents to pass stories along to grandchildren, thereby setting up the idea that there's a past that extends farther back than one's own existence. Then again, maybe I just like this explanation because I like telling my granddaughter stories, and so far she likes listening to them. In grade school, we all learned the history of Pennsylvania. We learned how William Penn was granted the area that is now Pennsylvania by King Charles II to pay off some serious debts that the king owed William's family. This land grant came as a really unpleasant surprise to the Native Americans who were already living on the land and who started wondering who all those strangers were. We learned how he worked to colonize the land with Quakers, and how the Quakers generally didn't treat the Native Americans nearly as badly as other colonists did. By the way, those early Quakers included my wife's ancestors. She's a 13th generation Quaker. Then other stuff happened. Eventually, around a century later, there was a Declaration of Independence written and signed in Philadelphia, a revolution, a really cold winter at Valley Forge, a constitution, again, penned in the city of brotherly love. Ben Franklin did a bunch of really cool stuff, and lots of other important things happened that we don't have time to delve into here. But to understand the history of Pennsylvania, we have to dig much deeper, because whether we like it or not, Pennsylvania is so much more than Steelers versus Eagles and Phillies versus Pirates, and way more than an unhealthy fascination with that inconceivable stuff that still sends shivers up my spine. Of course, I'm talking about Scrapple. So where to start? Any starting point in discussing history is arbitrary. We could start at the beginning. Do we really want to start it with the Big Bang? So we have to pick an arbitrary starting point, and I'm going to pick that point, and I'm picking the beginning of the Cambrian period, about 542 million years ago. Why start here? Well, if you look at reconstructions of the position of the continents over time, and here I'm giving a shout out to Christopher Scotese, who I was lucky enough to meet and speak with at GSA a few years ago. This is approximately when we see the beginnings of the Craton of Laurentia, which is the core of the North American continent, sticking up out of the water between the Iapetus and Panthalassic oceans. Now let me take a step back. If you're not a geologist, or if you are and you didn't pay attention in class, you know who you guys are, I'm not mentioning any names here, then we may need to do a little bit of review. Plate tectonics is the underlying theory that explains a lot about how the Earth operates and what makes her unique. Plate tectonics was still a relatively new theory when it was taught to me way back in 1976. So many people in the past have noticed that if you look at a map of the world, that the outlines of some continents match up. West Africa matches up almost perfectly with Eastern South America. Benjamin Franklin commented on this, and he wasn't even nearly the first to notice it. But I must say that if you look into anything in the sciences, you are likely to hear Ben's name mentioned. The guy was a genius, with a fair measure of ADD in the mixture. But it was Alfred Wegener in the early 1900s who used correlations of geologic features between, for example, New England and the British Isles, and Africa and South America, to theorize that the continents had moved. He called this theory continental drift. Unfortunately, he couldn't come up with a mechanism for why or how a continent could move. Alfred, a meteorologist, joked that he had been caught practicing geology without a license. When his theory wasn't accepted, he went back to meteorological research and tragically perished during an expedition to Greenland. It turns out Alfred had organized an expedition that was to overwinter in Greenland and collect meteorological data. When they started running short of provisions, he and another scientist successfully resupplied the team, but the weather turned bad and they disappeared on the return run. Their bodies were found months later. It wasn't until 1964 when a guy named Harry Hess reworked and restated the theory as plate tectonics. Now, Harry Hess is a hero of mine. Harry Hess came from a time when working class people didn't go to college. Rich people went to college. Working class people went to work. Now, maybe it's because I grew up in a working class family. My father was a steel worker, as I said before, in Ambridge, Pennsylvania. Maybe that's why I identify with Harry so much. Harry found a way to go to college, though. And part of how he funded this was to join the Naval Reserves. Now, Harry didn't do so well at first as an undergraduate, kind of like I did. Harry failed mineralogy on his first try. His professor told him that he had no aptitude for geology and really should find another area to study. But Harry buckled down and persevered and graduated, eventually got his doctorate, and became a professor at Princeton University, which is not too shabby. When World War II broke out, Harry was activated. Now, wars are bad things. I'm opposed to them. But sometimes, really good things can come out of a war. This is largely because in a major war like World War II, where the entire nation is mobilized, people from all walks of life are thrown into the mix, and different talents rise to the surface. In Harry's case, he was given command of a combat transport ship. His job was to get men and material across the Pacific to battles in the South Pacific. His ship saw service in a number of famous battles. The Battle of Leyte Gulf, the Iwo Jima, a number of others. And Harry's ship was equipped with a new instrument called a fathometer. Now, you can get something way more sophisticated than the fathometer that Harry's ship had just by going to Dick's Sporting Goods and buying a fish finder for $50 or $100. But this was radical new technology at the time. This fathometer was meant to tell how deep the water was so that the ship could approach land, get as close as possible before offloading men and material. In a combat situation, you want to get as close to shore as possible. Now, Harry, as they steamed out of the harbor the first time, realized that he had an opportunity on his hands. He had been taught as an undergraduate that the bottom of the ocean was flat, that it was this flat, featureless, abyssal plain, and he had a chance to see it. So he ordered the fathometer switched on and left on. And as they crossed the Pacific, he expected to see this flat, featureless abyssal plain. But that's not what they saw. Instead, they found these isolated flat-topped mountains underwater. Nobody had ever thought of a mountain under the ocean before. And out towards the middle of the Pacific, he discovered a mountain range. On subsequent voyages, he continued finding these things. When the war was over, he approached his superiors and said, "We should continue mapping the ocean floor." When they asked why, his response was, "Well, remember how effective submarines were in that war? If we know where these mountains and valleys are, we can hide submarines in them." And they said, "Ah, good idea. Let's continue the mapping." It's because of this mapping that we now have an understanding of what the ocean floor looks like. We understand that we have mid-oceanic ridges. And Harry was the first one to point out that this is probably the place where magma is upwelling and pushing open the surface of the Earth. And he envisioned the Earth as being covered in a series of plates. And this magma was pushing those plates apart, creating new surface. And in other places, plates were colliding and material was going back down into the interior. And he called this theory plate tectonics. It is the basis of modern plate tectonics and our understanding of how the Earth works. So plate tectonics tells us that the continents and the oceanic plates on Earth are in constant motion. Some are colliding, some are moving away from each other, some are moving past each other. This is the source of our mountain ranges and valleys, as well as most of our volcanoes and earthquakes. Turns out it may also be the source of much of our atmosphere. Understanding this process is critical to understanding the geologic history of Pennsylvania, because Pennsylvania has been in the position of both collisions and breaking up of the surface of the Earth and creating new crust. Now let's go back to the Cambrian period, to the beginnings of Laurentia, and therefore to what would become Pennsylvania. In the early Cambrian, the supercontinent of Pannotia has recently broken up. Sea levels are rising worldwide, and oceans are inundating low-lying areas. This is the beginning of what is known as the Salk Transgression. In this period of ocean onlapping, much and sometimes all of what would later become Pennsylvania is underwater. This is the time of the so-called Cambrian Explosion. Perhaps not the best wording, as it wasn't so much of an explosion as it was an emergence and diversification of life. While the Proterozoic biome was dominated by essentially pond scum, stromatolites, and a few shallow burrowing Ediacaran, the Cambrian saw a wide divergence of complex, multicellular life forms. One theory to explain this sudden onset of complex life is the possibility that the Earth's solid inner core may have recently settled down and reached a size that produced a significant enough magnetosphere to protect life on the surface from solar radiation. By the way, we did a podcast on this topic not too long ago. This allowed for the proliferation of life in the widespread shallow seas, including the first trilobites, a lineage that would eventually go on to win the hearts and minds of Pennsylvania legislators and become our state fossil. As Laurentia split away from Gondwana, Gondwana, by the way, is the remainder of the supercontinent of Pannotia, the Iapetus Ocean was opening between the two. As this new ocean grew, the continents continued to move apart. This all started about 550 million years ago. Now, these two continents were splitting apart as the Cambrian period eventually gave way to the Ordovician period. By the Ordovician, an island arc had formed between the two. This would become the Taconic Island Arc. As the Taconic Arc grew, it separated the Iapetus Ocean from the Rayic Ocean. As the Rayic Ocean closed, the Taconic Island arc collided with and became accreted onto Laurentia in what is now referred to as the Taconic Orogeny. It's worth taking a minute to talk briefly about orogenies. An orogeny is a mountain-building event, though event may not be the best term to use for something that takes millions of years to occur. I mean, seriously, pull up a seat in northern Italy and look at the Alps. You might eat some great food, drink some great wine, but the Alps aren't going to get much bigger while you watch. Yet an orogeny is going on there. Some argue that the concept of an orogeny is antiquated, but in retrospect, it is a useful concept to allow us to conceptualize the past. As land masses collide at a convergent boundary, the rocks are compressed, they're folded, they're faulted, and they're uplifted to form mountains. This process of orogenesis involves not just this deformation of existing rock, but it also involves volcanism. Now, imagine two tractor trailers colliding head-on at high speed. One would expect there to be significant change in the shape of these two large trucks, as well as modifications to their structure. One might also expect some pyrotechnics to occur. Now, scale this up to the size of continents, and you might be able to imagine what this process of orogenesis is like. The volcanism resulting from orogenesis creates new crust, bringing less dense material to the surface. But back to the Taconic Orogeny. Here in the Ordovician, we see the tectonic arc being accreted onto what is now the northeastern portion of North America. This forced the eastern edge of the craton downward, helping to bring on the Salk transgression. The volcanism resulting from this collision is evidenced by layers of volcanic ash, now converted to the clay mineral bentonite, interbedded within Ordovician limestones found throughout the foreland basins of eastern North America. The Taconic Orogeny would last for over 100 million years and is generally considered to have ended about 440 million years ago in the early Silurian period. The Taconic Mountains of eastern New York and western Massachusetts are remnants of this orogeny. As the Ordovician transitioned into the Silurian period, the cratons of Laurentia and Baltica, still sitting roughly astride the equator, converged upon each other. Rising sea levels flooded much of both cratons as the Tippecanoe transgression occurs. As Baltica collides with and accretes onto Laurentia, the Avalonian island arc closes in on what is now the east coast of North America. The Taconic Mountains, meanwhile, begin slowly eroding and depositing molass to the west across what is now Pennsylvania. Molass, unlike the dark, sticky remnant of sugar production with a similar name, is composed of conglomerates, sandstones, and shales eroded off of mountains and deposited in terrestrial or shallow marine sequences. This molass forms a wedge of material that can fill a foreland basin, leaving a relatively flat depositional surface. The silica-rich Tuscarora sandstone, which forms many of the ridges here in Pennsylvania and is much hated by thru-hikers of the Appalachian Trail, is part of this molass. While all of this mountain building and erosion was going on, some events were occurring that were thoroughly unremarkable at the time, but would become of great interest in the future. While sea levels rose and fell, the margins of where the water meets the land were slowly changing character. They were starting to turn green. Slowly, so slowly that it was hardly noticeable at the time, simple plants like mosses and liverworts were starting to colonize the shorelines. Over time, biomicrobial films had developed, which had started to glue loose sediments together. This had allowed the slow stabilization of loose deposits and the development of the first soils. These soils were a treasure trove of nutrients that these early plants learned to exploit. As these plants took root, they further stabilized the soils and started to set up an ecosystem that would entice invertebrates to join them. By the Silurian, the now green shorelines would lure Eurypterids and other arthropods out of the water and onto the land. The western portion of Pennsylvania and much of the area to the west were flooded by the Tippecanoe transgression. As these waters receded in the late Silurian, extensive evaporite deposits were left behind. As these were buried by the moass from the eroding Taconic Mountains, salt domes formed. Now, salt, or halite, is an interesting mineral on many levels. It's vital to life, but dangerous at the same time. Too much salt can cause high blood pressure, heart disease, and even death. Too little salt, and your food lacks flavor. Seriously, try eating a salt-free potato chip sometimes. It's downright depressing. Too little salt on the roads in the winter means the traffic comes to a standstill. Too much, and our cars all rot out prematurely. This is a mineral that literally rots concrete and steel, but at the same time sustains life. One of halite's attributes is that it doesn't compress, but under stress, it can act like a semi-liquid and flow. This means that salt that is buried under other deposits, as more deposits accumulate on top, will eventually find that it is less dense than the overlying rocks. Given half a chance, it'll start to flow upward, forming what is known as a diapir. This roughly teardrop-shaped object will slowly make its way upward until it reaches rocks of a similar or lighter density. There it will form a salt dome. Most of the salt spread on our roads when it snows. By the way, does anyone remember snow? We used to get snow in Pennsylvania. Most of that salt comes from salt domes left over from this time period. Many of those salt domes are underneath of Lake Erie and had their origins in the Silurian Basin. As the Silurian period gave way to the Devonian, the Rayic Ocean continued to narrow as the continent of Gondwana, containing what is now Africa, closed in on Laurentia. In the later part of the Devonian, the Avalonian Island Arc would be accreted onto Laurentia and the Acadian Orogeny is well underway, raising the Acadian Mountains in the eastern part of the continent. Sediment washing off of these mountains would form the Allegheny and Cumberland Plateaus, where one day the young version of a now balding soil scientist and geologist would first become fascinated by the rocks derived from this deposition. This orogeny would continue for 50 million years, eventually transitioning into the Alleghenian orogeny as the Devonian gave way to the Carboniferous period. In this episode of mountain building, Gondwana would collide with Laurentia, compressing and shortening the eastern portion of what is now North America by over 300 kilometers and forming extensive metamorphic rocks, such as those now exposed in southeastern Pennsylvania. As part of this collision, the Appalachians would rise to heights rivaling the modern Himalayas. The Atlas Mountains in what is now Morocco and the modern Western Sahara would also come into existence. This chapter also sees the formation of the supercontinent of Pangaea. Meanwhile, some seemingly minor players have entered the scene. Those mossy green shorelines have spread inland, and large portions of the land are now carpeted in vegetation. The arthropods that were lured ashore by the green are now widespread. Now, you may have heard the phrase that life emerged from the oceans. That's probably not the best way to characterize this. Life was chased out of the oceans. In the sea, things have gotten big and mean. Sharks are now widespread in the oceans, but unlike today, they're not the apex predators of the deep. Instead, a fish called Dunkleosteus rules the waves, tipping the scales at over a ton. This 30-foot-long creature epitomizes the rush by the denizens of the deep to get bigger and hungrier and meaner. It would seem that survival meant you had to either get big or get out. The tetrapods, rather wisely, emerged onto land. The first amphibians inhabiting the land would eventually give rise to the first reptiles and then the synapsids, our direct ancestors. In the western part of Pennsylvania, rainwater draining off of the Allegheny Mountains fed low-lying swamps that would dominate the area. These would in time yield the coal that would fuel the Industrial Revolution and the steel industry that would help build the nation. An accident of geologic fate would place the three ingredients to make steel, iron ore, limestone, and coal, within close proximity of the confluence of the Allegheny, Monongahela, and Ohio rivers. The growth of Pittsburgh's steel industry paralleled and fed the growth of the nation. Pittsburgh's steel output would produce roughly half of the steel used in the building of the national infrastructure in the 19th and 20th centuries. The formation of Pangaea would weld most of the land surface on the planet into one giant supercontinent, with climatic consequences that would stretch far into the future. Now, having a single supercontinent may seem like a nice idea, but the implications are widespread. The Earth's climate is strongly influenced by ocean currents. For example, London, England is located at 51.5 degrees north latitude, give or take, about the same latitude as northern Newfoundland. Yet it enjoys a climate much more similar to Pennsylvania, which is found over 11 degrees to the south. This is because of the influence of the Atlantic Meridionally Overturning Circulation, or AMOC. Most people, if they're aware of it at all, know of this as the Gulf Stream, though the Gulf Stream is really only a portion of the AMOC. And the AMOC is in turn only a portion of the global thermohaline circulation, a giant heat pump that redistributes heat from tropical areas to, for example, Great Britain and Northern Europe. Without this heat reallocation, the climate of Northern Europe would more resemble that of Greenland than of Pennsylvania. With the formation of the supercontinent of Pangaea, the influence of a global thermohaline circulation would be minimized to only influencing coastal areas. The vast interior of the continent would exhibit climates that are more reflective of latitude alone. This made for huge swaths of inhospitable landscape, the sort that would make the Sahara Desert seem mild in comparison. The consolidation of a single landmass also meant the consolidation of a single ocean that dominated the planet. This was the Panthalassic Ocean. Now, this wasn't the only salty water body on the planet, just the biggest, kind of a super Pacific Ocean, if you will. It covered about 70% of the Earth's land surface. Now, one of the factors in how large tropical storms like hurricanes and typhoons can become is the size of the water body where they are spawned and grow. The fetch of the storm, that is how much ocean it can cross as it grows, is really important. The longer the storm has to grow as it moves across warm water, the larger it will become. This is why we see more Category 5 typhoons in the Pacific in a given year than we do Category 5 hurricanes in the Atlantic. So imagine, if you will, how large a tropical storm could become when it forms over an ocean that spans nearly 3/4 of the globe. Another factor in storm strength is the temperature of the water, with more heat leading to larger and stronger storms. This is important because temperatures in the Paleozoic were generally significantly warmer than they are today. These factors combined means much stronger tropical storms than we see today. computer simulations under these conditions suggest that storms dubbed hypercanes would be a regular occurrence. We're talking about truly devastating storms with wind speeds in excess of 800 kilometers per hour. Storms the size of North America that could last for weeks at a time. The point of all this is that the Permian world was a very inhospitable place to live. Yet somehow, life pushed forward anyway. Although we see evidence of widespread die-offs throughout the Permian period, we also see proliferation of life with the synapsids dominating the inhospitable portions of the land. The coal swamps largely came to an end in this period. The drying climate led to extinctions among the spore-bearing plants and the amphibians, leaving more room for the synapsids. The expansion of drier climates led to the proliferation of the gymnosperms, the seed-bearing plants. These replaced the spore-bearing plants. Seeds are better suited to weathering dry conditions. This gave the gymnosperms the edge. The generally forbidding conditions of the Permian somehow managed to get even worse about 252 million years ago. The end of the Permian saw the single largest mass extinction in the history of the planet, so bad that it has been dubbed the Great Dying. Over 70% of terrestrial vertebrate species went extinct, along with 96% of marine species. Roughly 83% of genera on the planet vanished in this event. The cause of this catastrophe is hard to pin down, mainly because there were just so many bad things going on at the time. There was at least one large bolide impact at this time. We see evidence of widespread volcanism with flood basalts producing the Siberian traps, an event that would disgorge approximately 4 million cubic kilometers of volcanic rock. This released tremendous amounts of carbon dioxide and sulfur dioxide into the atmosphere, sparking widespread anoxia in the oceans, as well as warming of the climate. This increase in temperature appears to then have released methane, stored in the form of methane clathrates, which are essentially methane ice in the bottoms of the oceans, into the atmosphere, further exacerbating the warming, because methane is a much stronger greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Now, this is a pattern that those of us who are not yet extinct should really pay attention to today. This mass extinction saw the demise of lineages that go back hundreds of millions of years, including the previously ubiquitous trilobites. It also cleared the way for a previously minor lineage that would lead to the largest and to this day possibly the most fascinating group of creatures ever to walk the planet, the dinosaurs. The end of the Permian meant the end of the Paleozoic era and the beginning of the Mesozoic era. The mighty Appalachians were eroding during this time, and we see the origins of the Triassic red beds that would blanket the eastern flanks of the mountains and the soon-to-be-open Gettysburg-Newark Basin. The Triassic period saw the beginnings of the rise of the dinosaurs, though the beginnings were humble, with the apex predator of the day, Coelophysis, being not much larger than a large dog if you ignore the long tail. The largest herbivore, Plateosaurus, was no larger than a mid-sized cow today. These creatures would leave their tracks in the thickening sediments that were sloughing off of the Appalachians. For example, during the building of the Limerick Nuclear Power Plant on the north shore of the Schuylkill River, excavation exposed the Triassic Brunswick Formation and some fine examples of Coelophysis tracks. While the dinosaurs are solidifying their place on the planet, things are stirring in the planet's interior. As it turns out, when all the continents come together, it acts rather like what happens when you pile up too many blankets on a sleeping person. Heat builds up. While with humans this usually just leads to sweaty sheets, with continents it has a more spectacular effect. Imagine holding a candle under a sheet of paper. Eventually the paper is going to heat up and the candle's flame is going to burn a hole in it. Now don't try this at home. just use your imagination. We don't want any fire companies being called because of this podcast. But imagine trying to do this with a ream of copy paper. You'll get a similar result, but it's going to take longer. So all the while the Pangaea was together, heat was building up, just looking for an outlet. Indeed, this may have contributed to the eruption of the aforementioned Siberian traps. Eventually, that heat is going to manifest itself in the form of magma plumes. These plumes would come to tear Pangaea apart. In the late Triassic period, about 201 million years ago, the difficult relationship that had so far held Pangaea together started to come to an end with the opening of a rift valley. This was no small rift valley like the one opening in East Africa today. That one is a minor anemic cousin in comparison. This rift valley stretched from modern-day central Brazil through Africa, North America, and Europe, eventually stretching over 5,000 kilometers. This spawned the creation of the Central Atlantic Magmatic Province, the largest continental igneous province on the planet. It would eventually cover over 11 million square kilometers. Over the course of about 600,000 years, this rifting disgorged perhaps the single largest mass of volcanic rock in the last half billion years. The total mass of material erupted is somewhere on the order of about 6 million cubic kilometers. The splitting up of Pangaea would bring about the birth of the Atlantic Ocean, which is still opening to this day. It also meant something else, the splitting up and stretching of Pennsylvania. This split up wasn't one single event, but occurred in four pulses. The earlier pulse or pulses started to split Pennsylvania. This produced the Gettysburg Newark Basin, which is itself only a portion of the more widespread North American basin. This basin, very descriptively, stretching from south of Gettysburg up across northern New Jersey and into New York, is the result of this rifting. In the early parts of the rifting, southeastern Pennsylvania was moving eastward along with what would become Africa. Now, some listeners might agree with some of my relatives out in the Pittsburgh area and think that a Pennsylvania without Philadelphia is not a bad thing, but I tend to believe that having both Eagles and Steelers, Pirates and Phillies is a good thing. Apparently, the geologic powers that be thought the same, because the rifting paused at some point, and when it began again, it did so to the east, leading to the current Mid-Oceanic Rift that we now know today. The magmatic intrusions and flood basalts that arose from this rifting event would eventually have a profound effect on the pivotal battle between the Union and the Confederacy during the American Civil War. Some of these rocks from this rifting event are still visible on the surface here in Pennsylvania. But let's give some credit to our neighbor to the east, New Jersey. There, these rocks are spectacularly displayed in the Palisades, the cliffs that overlook New York City. So the rifting of Pangaea may have failed to split Pennsylvania in two, but it did succeed in creating the Atlantic Ocean and likely led to a mass extinction at the end of the Triassic. The climactic effects of such a huge outpouring of lava and the concurrent outgassing that would have occurred resulted in significant climatic shifts once again. Just as we saw with climatic disruptions in the late Permian, here again, climate change driven by increased carbon dioxide and methane in the atmosphere led to great loss of life and genetic diversity. In a relatively short time, less than 10,000 years, approximately 30% of marine genera vanished from the fossil record. But it's on land where the biggest changes were seen. Significant numbers of land plants, possibly up to 70% of them, disappeared in the climatic shifts. something on the order of 42% of terrestrial tetrapods went extinct, including reptiles and amphibians. The net result was the loss of most of the competitors of the dinosaurs of the time, thereby ushering in the Jurassic period and the dominance of dinosaurs. The Jurassic and the following Cretaceous period, though exciting due to the continued breakup of Pangaea, which, by the way, is still going on today, and the proliferation of larger and larger dinosaurs, ushered in the beginning of a period of relative tectonic peace and quiet for the area that would become the Keystone State. This is the time of transition of this region from being an active margin to a passive margin. That doesn't mean that the time period was boring or contributed little to the current configuration of Pennsylvania, quite the contrary. Remember that the collision of Laurentia and the other continents had pushed up the Appalachian Mountains to a height that rivals today's Himalayas. The Mesozoic era would see the erosion of these mountains to a size that would be more familiar to us today. During the Mesozoic, Pennsylvania was still situated in the low latitudes. For much of that time, it was located in the tropics. Then, as today, most of the rainfall occurs in the tropics. Up to a third or half of the planet's rainfall, in fact, occurs in the tropics. These high precipitation levels enabled a tremendous amount of erosion over the roughly 186 million years that comprised the Mesozoic. Much of that sediment traveled northward toward present-day Hudson's Bay, which was the dominant westwards drainage pattern of the time. The drainage patterns of western Pennsylvania wouldn't resemble the current arrangement until the late Pliocene, but by the late Jurassic, the current east coast drainage pattern was becoming fairly well established. In the western and northern part of the state, drainage was to the north-northwest. In today's Pennsylvania, the Ohio River flows north from the confluence of the Allegheny and the Monongahela, then makes a sudden turn southwestward where the Beaver River flows in from the north around the towns of Monaca and Rochester, not too far from where I grew up. In the Mesozoic, this turn didn't occur, and what is now dubbed the Pittsburgh River flowed northward toward Hudson Bay. Most of the rivers to the north and west of the Appalachians did the same. In the east, the early Susquehanna and Schuylkill rivers were already established, though the Schuylkill was the larger of the two. The Susquehanna didn't reach up into New York as it does today. Instead, it only drained the southeastern face of the Appalachians. It wasn't until later, as the Appalachians eroded, that the Susquehanna was able to reach northward and capture the drainage patterns that flowed north in the Mesozoic. The rifting that opened the Gettysburg-Newark Basin had the added effect of stretching the crust on the eastern portion of the continent, which resulted in thinning. This set up an ideal area to receive large amounts of sediments. Erosion of the eastern face of the mountain range headed into the now low-lying basin, producing the red beds that we know today in that region. As the continent shifted location, it moved northward into the latitudes that are characterized by aridity. These are the latitudes that today support our low-latitude deserts. This allowed for the dry, highly oxygenated environment that produces the red sedimentary rocks. By this time, the Atlantic Ocean was about 1,600 kilometers wide, and the beginnings of today's modern ocean circulation patterns were beginning to form. By the mid-Jurassic, sediments eroded off of the eastern drainage of the Appalachians were reaching the continental margin and starting to form the modern-day Atlantic coastal plain. If you ever go to the beach in the summer, like I do, you can be grateful to this episode of erosion. The broad, flat Delmarva Peninsula and the lower part of New Jersey are largely composed of these Cretaceous sediments. I try to keep this in mind every year as my family makes their annual trek to the Delaware beaches. Now, much of my field work these days is in Delaware, and I find myself digging into these Cretaceous sediments regularly. These sediments are wedge-shaped, with the thin end starting at the edge of the Piedmont, which lies roughly along Interstate 95, which parallels the fall line, then thickening as you move south and east toward the Atlantic. The effect of the tropical rainfall of the time means that by the late Cretaceous, the Appalachians were reduced in volume by about 90%, with the Delmarva Peninsula being one of the lucky recipients of this bounty of sediments. So, as I make sandcastles with my granddaughter on the beach in Delaware, I always try to point out that the same sand that we are playing with likely originated in high mountains to the northwest, and that it might have just stuck to the feet of dinosaurs just like it does to us. As you may know, the end of the Mesozoic came with a bang. While the controversy about the exact cause of the extinction of the non-avian dinosaurs continues to rage on, two major events occurred that likely interacted. In the Indian subcontinent, we saw extensive eruptions of the Deccan Traps, another large igneous province. The eruption of the Deccan Traps would have had significant influence on the environment of the time, just as the eruption of the Siberian Traps had in the Permian period. And in and of itself, this would have done a number on the dinosaurs. It just so happens that while the Deccan Traps were doing their thing, a rock about the size of Mount Everest decided to slam into the Gulf of Mexico off the coast of the current-day Yucatan Peninsula. Coincidentally, this location was nearly antipodal to the Indian subcontinent at the time. That is to say that they were very nearly directly opposite each other. Now, it doesn't take too much of a stretch of the imagination to envision seismic waves from an earthquake with a magnitude of, say, 10 or 11 on the Richter scale, making the eruptions directly opposite it on the Earth significantly worse. This, along with the firestorm, the tsunami, and the ejecta storm that ensued from the impact, pretty much made certain that our immediate ancestors would never have to fight off velociraptors or T-Rex. Although this probably made for a really bad day anywhere in Pennsylvania, the effect of this on the geologic record here in the Keystone State is negligible. We won't wade into the debate about the demise of the dinosaurs here today, since it really isn't relevant, and besides, we don't want to step on a topic for a future podcast. With the Mesozoic now in the past and the Cenozoic ahead of us, we have about 66 million years of Pennsylvania history to discuss. Curiously, though, we find very little record of this period in the history of the Quaker State outside of the Pleistocene glaciations. This is most likely because of the Pleistocene glaciations, which would have wiped out a lot of the evidence of any major Cenozoic changes. We do know that the elevation of Pennsylvania at the onset of the Paleogene period was much higher than today. We do see one exciting event when about 35 million years ago during the Eocene, a rock about 2 to 5 kilometers in diameter slammed into the Chesapeake Bay, creating a crater about 40 kilometers in diameter. Ejecta from this likely spread across part of Pennsylvania, and some suggest that some of the fracture traces that we see today may have originated in this event. Some suggest that the presence of this crater and the fractured bedrock beneath are the reason why the Susquehanna and the Chesapeake Bay changes from its north-south course as it crosses the crater and makes a 90-degree turn to the east. Still, though this event was likely spectacular to witness, it had relatively little long-term effect on the geology of Pennsylvania. We don't see much evidence of extreme erosion in the Appalachians until about 16 million years ago during the Miocene period. In fact, the period from the Paleocene to the Miocene, stretching roughly from 66 to about 16 million years ago, shows the lowest period of sedimentary accumulation in the coastal plain. This leads many to surmise that the climate of that time period in this region was relatively stable, though we certainly see fluctuations elsewhere on the planet during this time. there's evidence of a slow increase in temperature and precipitation during the early Miocene, leading to the development of rainforest on the eastern flanks of the Appalachians. We do see the widespread development of saprolite through this time period as well. By the middle part of the Miocene, we see a dramatic climatic shift with changes in precipitation and lower temperatures, with the climate shifting to a humid subtropical environment. This led to a significant increase in erosion. It's estimated that about 3,000 feet of rock was eroded from the flanks of the Appalachians since the Miocene. We might expect that the removal of 3,000 feet of rock would largely flatten an area, yet the Keystone State still boasts significant relief. This is due to isostatic uplift. For a continent to be able to support mountains, there needs to be a significant thickness of bedrock beneath those mountains. It's estimated that roughly 7 times the mass of the mountain range would be expressed in a bulge beneath the range, supported on the semi-plastic surface of the mantle. This means that as mountains erode, this mass, which is lighter than the mantle, is going to float upward. As an analogy, imagine being in a canoe with 2 other people. The canoe is riding rather low in the water and runs aground in some shallows. So one person climbs out, and the canoe lifts up and floats again. Isostatic uplift works the same way. Ironically, this means that erosion leads to continued mountain growth, which is a little counterintuitive. But this explains how we still have ridges and hills, which we sometimes refer to as mountains, in Pennsylvania after so much erosion. Major climatic shifts occurred with the onset of the Pleistocene about 2.6 million years ago, and this brought about many profound changes to the state. By this time, the modern drainage patterns were settling in. The Susquehanna had eroded northward enough to capture other rivers and establish its current watershed. The Allegheny and Monongahela rivers now joined to form the Ohio River, and the Ohio River turned southward and joined the Mississippi as a tributary. Humans were appearing on the scene with the changes that Homo sapiens bring. The Great Lakes would be scoured out by the continental glaciers. The extreme cold of the glacial cycles would yield numerous features, including the numerous talus slopes that can be seen in the Poconos and the Ridge and Valley Province. It would be tempting to go into great detail on the glaciations, but we did do a separate podcast on that topic not too long ago. Throughout the Pleistocene, glacial periods were followed by interglacials over and over again. Cold periods followed by warm, then by cold again. The glaciers removed material from some areas and reworked and deposited material in other areas, leaving moraines and drumlins, eskers, erratics, and a bunch of other glacial features. As the landscape warmed at the end of the last glacial maximum, the Laurentide ice sheet retreated and permafrost thawed. When this happened, the thawed soil often slumped down off of slopes into low-lying areas in the process of solifluction. Imagine a big spoonful of pudding dropped on a plate, then the plate is tilted, and the pudding slowly oozes down the face of the plate. This happened across the state, in part helping to form some of our floodplains. LIDAR imagery shows some of these solifluction lobes still recognizable to this day, trapped in place by the trees that grew upon them. As the climate warmed, humans spread across the landscape, and before we knew it, we had highways, dams, strip malls, and subdivisions, as well as those all-important road cuts that help us learn geology. Some would argue that in the present day, the human impact on the geology of the state is perhaps as significant as natural forces. Or maybe it is just human vanity to think so. I don't want to wade into the argument over whether we're in the Holocene or the Anthropocene or just still in the Pleistocene just yet. But all this has brought us to the present day, where we come to realize that Pennsylvania's geology is really complicated. Maybe not the most complex of any state, but this isn't meant to be a contest. Pennsylvania geology is complicated and fascinating, but honestly, still not completely understood. There's plenty of gaps left to be filled in this particular story. Some of the concepts that we were taught back in the 70s and 80s have been replaced with better explanations. I expect that someone listening to this may, in 5 or 10 or 50 years, or maybe just a month or so, come up with a better explanation for a portion of this narrative. Some might even email me within minutes of listening to this podcast to dispute some of the details or call attention to things that I've missed, and I know I have missed some things. After all, I'm still learning, as we all are. Or they may want to point out something that is being disputed today. That's fine. Such is the nature of science. It is never settled, but remains an ongoing process of discovery and learning. I hope you enjoyed this little history of our great state, but whether you enjoyed it or not, hopefully this gives you some idea of how Pennsylvania got to have such wonderfully complex geology. A geologic history that is so complicated that it surely guarantees us geologists plenty of opportunities for discovery, and most likely a bit of job security as well. This episode of the PCPG podcast, a poorly sorted but well-rounded series, is a production of the Pennsylvania Council of Professional Geologists. A special thank you to Naomi Groves for the introduction. These podcasts are hosted on several platforms and also available on the PCPG website. If you enjoyed this episode, please consider taking a moment to give us a rating and leave us a comment to let us know what you think. Remember to subscribe so you don't miss any future episodes. PCPG is a nonprofit organization working to advance the practice of geology and the allied sciences and the success of our members through advocacy, education, and networking. Whether you are a corporation, a professional, or a student, please consider becoming a PCPG member today. Just visit our website, pcpg.org, and be sure to check out the Resources tab. If you have a question or an idea for a new podcast, feel free to email me at soildude@comcast.net. That's SOILDUDE @comcast.net. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Russ Losko.